Blog Talk Radio.
We must also realize that the problems of racial injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved without a radical redistribution of political and economic power.
We read one day, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if a man doesn't have a job or an income, he has neither life nor liberty and the possibility for the pursuit of happiness. He merely exists."
Estimated that we spend $322,000 for each enemy we kill in Vietnam, while we spend in the so-called war on poverty in America only about $53 for each person classified as poor.
The promises of the Great Society have been shot down on the battlefield of Vietnam, making the poor, white and Negro, bear the heaviest burdens both at the front and at home.
The other thing I want you to understand is this, that it didn't cost the nation one penny to integrate lunch counts. It didn't cost the nation one penny to guarantee the right to vote. But now we are dealing with issues that cannot be solved without the nation spending billions of dollars and undergoing a radical redistribution of economic power.
Yes.
All labor has dignity.
Yes.
But you are doing another thing. You are reminding not only Memphis, but you are reminding the nation that it is a crime for people to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wages.
America's opportunity to help bridge the gulf between the haves and the have-nots. And the question is whether America will do it. There's nothing new about poverty. What is new is that we now have the techniques and the resources to get rid of poverty. And the real question is whether we have the will.
At the very same time that America refused to give the Negro any land, through an act of Congress, our government was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that it was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor. But not only did they give the land, they built land-grant colleges with government money to teach them how to farm. Not only that, they provided county agents to further their expertise in farming. Not only that, they provided low interest rates in order that they could mechanize their farms. Not only that, today many of these people are receiving millions of dollars in federal subsidies not to farm, and they are the very people telling the black man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. Now, this is what we are faced with, and this is the reality. Now, when we come to Washington in this campaign, we are coming to get our check.
I come here tonight and plead with you. Believe in yourself and believe that you're somebody. As I said to the group last night, nobody else can do this for us. No document can do this for us.
No Lincolnian Emancipation Proclamation can do this for us. No Kennisonian or Johnsonian Civil Rights Bill can do this for us. If the Negro is to be free, he must move down into the inner resources of his own soul and sign with the pen and ink of self-assertive manhood his own Emancipation Proclamation. Don't let anybody take your manhood. Be proud of our heritage. As somebody said earlier tonight, we don't have anything to be ashamed of. Somebody told a lie one day. They couched it in language. They made everything black, ugly, and evil. Look in your dictionary and see the synonyms of the word black. It's always something degrading and low and sinister. Look at the word white. It's always something pure, high, and clean. But I want to get the language right tonight. I want to get the language so right that everybody here will cry out, yes, I'm black, I'm proud of it, I'm black and beautiful.
What is the relationship between this and the reality of the Negro masses?
Well, to move on out of it.
But if not, there was a day when many of the Israelites found themselves in bondage in Babylon. And there was a king of Babylon by the name of Nebuchadnezzar. You read about him a good deal in the book of Daniel, and it stands as an epic that will remain stenciled on the mental sheets of unfolding generations. Nebuchadnezzar was a mighty king. And when he ruled, he ruled. And when he issued an order, he meant business. And Nebuchadnezzar issued an order. He made a golden image, and his order was that everybody.
To understand this, you have to go back to what young brother here referred to as the house Negro and the field Negro back during slavery. There was two kinds of slaves. There was the house Negro and the field Negro. The house Negro, they lived in the house with master. They dressed pretty good. They ate good because they ate his food because he left. They lived in the attic or the basement, but still they lived near their master. And they loved their master more than the master loved himself. They would give their life to save their master's house quicker than the master would. The house Negro, if the master said, we got a good house here, the house Negro said, yeah, we got a good house here. Whenever the master said we, he said we. That's how you can tell a house Negro. If the master's house caught on fire, the house Negro would fight harder to put the blaze out than the master would. If the master got sick, the house Negro would say, what's the matter, boss? We sick. We sick. He identified himself with his master more than his master identified with himself. And if you came to the house Negro and said, let's run away, let's escape, let's separate, that house Negro would look at you and say, man, you crazy. What you mean separate? Where is there a better house than this? Where can I wear better clothes than this? Where can I eat better food than this? That was that house Negro. In those days, he was called a house nigger. And that's what we call him today, because we still got some house niggers running around here. This modern house Negro loves his master. He wants to live near him. He'll pay three times as much as the house is worth just to live near his master. And then brag about, I'm the only Negro out here.
I'm the only one on my job. I'm the only one in this school. You're nothing but a house Negro. And if someone come to you right now and say, let's separate, you say the same thing that the house Negro said on the plantation. What you mean, separate? From America? This good white man? Where you gonna get a better job than you get here? I mean, this is what you say. I ain't left nothing in Africa. That's what you say. Why, you left your mind in Africa. On that same plantation, there was the field Negro. The field Negro, those were the masses. There was always more Negroes in the field than there was Negroes in the house. The Negro in the field caught hell. He ate leftovers. In the house, they ate high up on the hog. The Negro in the field didn't get nothing but what was left of the insides of the hog. They call them chitlins nowadays. In those days, they call them what they were, guts. That's what you were, a gut eater. And some of you are still gut eaters. The field Negro was beaten from morning till night. He lived in a shack, in a hut. He wore cast-off clothes. And he hated his master. I say he hated his master. He was intelligent. That house Negro loved his master. But that field Negro, remember, they were in the majority. And they hated the master. When the house caught on fire, he didn't try and put it out. That field Negro prayed for a wind, for a breeze. When the master got sick, the field Negro prayed that he died. If someone come to the field Negro and said, let's separate, let's run, he didn't say, where are we going? He said, any place is better than here. You got field Negroes in America today. I'm a field Negro. The masters are the field Negroes. When they see this man's house on fire, you don't hear these little Negroes talking about our government is in trouble. They say the government is in trouble. Imagine a Negro, our government. I even heard one say, our astronauts. They won't even let him near the plant. And our astronauts. Our Navy. That's a Negro that's out of his mind. That's a Negro that's out of his mind. Just as the slave master in that day used Tom, the house Negro, to keep the field Negroes in check, the same old slave master today has Negroes who are nothing but modern Uncle Toms, 20th century Uncle Toms. to keep you and me in check, keep us under control, keep us passive and peaceful in nonviolent. That's Tom making you nonviolent. It's like when you go to the dentist and the man is going to take your tooth. You're going to fight him when he starts pulling. So they squirt some stuff in your jaw called Novocaine to make you think they're not doing anything to you. So you sit there and because you got all that Novocaine in your jaw, you suffer peacefully. Blood running all down your jaw. And you don't know what's happening. Because someone has taught you to suffer peacefully. The white man do the same thing to you in the street. When he don't want to put knots on your head and take advantage of you and don't have to be afraid of you fighting back, to keep you from fighting back, he get these old religious Uncle Toms to teach you and me that just like Novocaine, suffer peacefully. Don't stop suffering, just suffer peacefully. As Reverend Cleve pointed out, let your blood flow in the streets. This is a shame. And you know, he's a Christian preacher. If it's a shame to him, you know what it is to me. Because nothing in our book, the Quran, as you call it, Koran, teaches us to suffer peacefully. Our religion teaches us to be intelligent, be peaceful, be courteous, obey the law, respect everyone. But if someone puts his hand on you, send him to the cemetery. That's a good religion. In fact, that's that old-time religion. That's the one that Ma and Pa used to talk about. An eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth, and a head for a head, and a life for a life. That's a good religion. And then anybody, no one resents that kind of religion being taught but a wolf who intends to make you his meal. This is the way it is with the white man in America. He's a wolf and you a sheep. Anytime a shepherd, a pastor, teach you and me not to run from the white man, and at the same time teachers don't fight the white man, he's a traitor to you and me. Don't lay down our life all by itself. No. Preserve your life. It's the best thing you got. And if you got to give it up, let it be even Stephen. The slave master took Tom and dressed him well and fed him well and even gave him a little education, a literal education. Gave him a long coat and a top hat and made all the other slaves look up to him. Then he used Tom to control them. The same strategy that was used in those days is used today by the same white man. He take a Negro, so-called Negro, and make him prominent. Build him up. Publicize him. Make him a celebrity. And then he becomes a spokesman for Negroes and a Negro leader. I would like to just mention one thing else quickly, and that is The method that the white man uses, how the white man uses these big guns or Negro leaders against the black revolution. They are not a part of the black revolution. they're used against the black revolution. When Martin Luther King failed to desegregate Albany, Georgia, the civil rights struggle in America reached its low point. King became bankrupt almost as a leader. Plus, even financially, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference was in financial trouble. Plus, it was in trouble, period, with the people when they failed to desegregate Albany, Georgia. Other Negro civil rights leaders of so-called national stature became fallen idols. As they became fallen idols, began to lose their prestige and influence, local Negro leaders began to stir up the masses. In Cambridge, Maryland, Gloria Richardson. In Danville, Virginia, and other parts of the country, local leaders begin to stir up our people at the grassroots level. This was never done by these Negroes whom you recognize of national stature. They controlled you, but they never incited you or excited you. They controlled you. They contained you. They kept you on the plantation. As soon as King failed in Birmingham, Negroes took to the streets. King got out and went out to California to a big rally and raised about, I don't know how many thousands of dollars. Come to Detroit and had a march and raised some more thousands of dollars. And recall, right after that, Wilkins attacked King, accused King and the Corps of starting trouble everywhere and then making the NAACP get him out of jail and spend a lot of money, and then they accused King and Corps of raising all the money and not paying it back. This happened. I got it in documented evidence in the newspaper. Roy started attacking King, and King started attacking Roy, and Farmer started attacking both of them. And as these Negroes of national stature began to attack each other, they began to lose their control of the Negro masses. And Negroes was out there in the streets. They was talking about, we're going to march on Washington. By the way, right at that time, Birmingham had exploded, and the Negroes in Birmingham, remember, they also exploded. They began to stab the crackers in the back and bust them upside their head. Yes, they did. That's when Kennedy sent in the troops down in Birmingham. So, and right after that, Kennedy got on the television and said, this is a moral issue. That's when he said he's going to put out a civil rights bill. And when he mentioned civil rights bill and the Southern crackers started talking about they were going to boycott it or filibuster it, then the Negroes started talking about what? We're going to march on Washington, march on the Senate, march on the White House, march on the Congress and tie it up, bring it to a halt. Don't let the government proceed. They even said they were going to go out to the airport and lay down on the runway and don't let no airplanes land. I'm telling you what they said. That was revolution. That was revolution. That was the black revolution. It was the grassroots out there in the street. Scared the white man to death. Scared the white power structure in Washington, D.C. to death. I was there. When they found out that this black steamroller was going to come down on the Capitol, they called in Wilkins. They called in Randolph. They called in these national Negro leaders that you respect. And told them, call it off. Kennedy said, look, y'all letting this thing go too far. And old Tom said, boss, I can't stop it because I didn't start it. I'm telling you what they said. They said, I'm not even in it, much less at the head of it. They said, these Negroes are doing things on their own. They're running ahead of us. And that old shrewd fox, he said, well, if you all aren't in it, I'll put you in it. I'll put you at the head of it. I'll endorse it. I'll welcome it. I'll help it. I'll join it. A matter of hours went by. They had a meeting at the Carlisle Hotel in New York City. The Carlisle Hotel is owned by the Kennedy family. That's the hotel Kennedy spent the night at two nights ago. Belongs to his family.
a philanthropic society headed by a white man named Stephen Currier called all the top civil rights leaders together at the Carlisle Hotel and told them that by you all fighting each other, you're destroying the civil rights movement. And since you're fighting over money from white liberals, let us set up what's known as the Council for United Civil Rights Leadership. Let's form this council, and all the civil rights organizations will belong to it. And we'll use it for fundraising purposes. Let me show you how tricky the white man is. And as soon as they got it formed, they elected Whitney Young as the chairman. And who you think became the co-chairman? Stephen Currier, the white man. A millionaire. Powell was talking about it down at the Cobo today. This is what he was talking about. Powell knows it happened. Randolph knows it happened. Wilkins knows it happened. King knows it happened. Every one of that so-called Big Six, they know what happened. Once they formed it, with the white man over it, he promised them and gave them $800,000 to split up between the Big Six and told them that after the march was over, they'd give them $700,000 more. $1.5 million split up between leaders that you've been following, going to jail for, crying crocodile tears for, and they've nothing but Frank James and Jesse James and brothers. Soon as they got the setup organized, the white man made available to them top public relations experts. Opened the news media across the country at their disposal. And then they began to project these Big Six as the leaders of the march. Originally, they weren't even in the march. You was talking this march talk on Hastings Street. Is Hastings Street still here? On Hastings Street. You was talking the march talk on Lenox Avenue. And out on, Fillmore Street, and Central Avenue, and 42nd Street, and 63rd Street. That's where the march talk was being talked. But the white man put the Big Six ahead of it, made them the march. They became the march. They took it over. And the first move they made after they took it over, they invited Walter Reuther, a white man. They invited a priest, a rabbi, and an old white preacher. Yes, an old white preacher. The same white element that put Kennedy in power, labor, the Catholics, the Jews, and liberal Protestants, same clique that put Kennedy in power, joined the March on Washington. It's just like when you got some coffee that's too black, which means it's too strong. What you do? You integrate it with cream. You make it weak. If you pour too much cream in, you won't even know you ever had coffee. It used to be hot, it becomes cool. It used to be strong, it becomes weak. It used to wake you up, now it'll put you to sleep. This is what they did with the March on Washington. They joined it. They didn't integrate it, they infiltrated it. They joined it, became a part of it, took it over. And as they took it over, it lost its militancy. They ceased to be angry. They ceased to be hot. They ceased to be uncompromising. Why, it even ceased to be a march. It became a picnic, a circus. Nothing but a circus with clowns and all. You had one right here in Detroit. I saw it on television with clowns leading it, white clowns and black clowns. I know you don't like what I'm saying, but I'm going to tell you anyway, because I can prove what I'm saying. If you think I'm telling you wrong, you bring me Martin Luther King and A. Philip Randolph and James Farmer and those other three and see if they'll deny it over the microphone. No, it was a sellout. It was a takeover. When James Baldwin came in from Paris, they wouldn't let him talk because they couldn't make him go by the script. Bert Lancaster wrote the speech that Baldwin was supposed to make. They wouldn't let Baldwin get up there because they know Baldwin was liable to say anything. They controlled it so tight, they told those Negroes what time to hit town, how to come, where to stop, what sign to carry, what song to sing, what speech they could make and what speech they couldn't make, and then told them to get out of town by sundown. And every one of those towns were out of town by sundown. Now, I know you don't like my saying this, but I can back it up. It was a circus, a performance. It beat anything Hollywood could ever do. The performance of the year. Luther and those other three devils should get a Academy Award for the best actors because they acted like they really loved Negroes and fooled a whole lot of Negroes. And the six Negro leaders should get an award, too, for the best supporting cast.
The hand of the Lord was upon me and carried me out in the spirit of the Lord and set me down in the midst of the valley which was full of bones and caused me to pass by them round about. And behold, there were very many in the open valley, and lo, they were very dry. And he said unto me, Son of man, can these bones live? And I answered, O Lord God, thou knowest. And again he said unto me, prophesy upon these bones, and say unto them, O ye dry bones, hear the word of the Lord. The prophet and the valley of dry bones. Among those who were carried away was a young man by the name of Ezekiel, who had obviously been trained to be a priest. When we study his minute descriptions of the temple order and of the temple liturgy, when we read of his intimate knowledge of things directly or indirectly concerned with Judaism, we must conclude that he had formal training as a priest. But along with the vision that Ezekiel reveals here, along with others that he records in his book, one thing he wanted to convince Israel of, that her God had not fallen, and her God was not dead. He wanted Israel to understand that her God, as he depicts in the vision where he saw the vague outline of a man sitting upon a chariot throne, engulfed in a cloud, and with priestly functionaries going in and coming out from the mercy seat. He was saying, he told him about wheels that he saw in the middle of wheels, and that these wheels were guarded by angels, and that these wheels had eyes, and that these wheels did not deviate from their course. He was telling Israel first about the overruling providence and power of God, and about Israel was a part of God's eternal plans and purposes. While Israel was one wheel, ever moving, and above that was another wheel, that was the Babylonian wheel, it was moving, and that above that was another wheel, which was God's universal wheel, and God's universal plan, and all of these wheels were moving, because all of God's plans are always moving. Maybe you think you have stopped him. Maybe you think you have blocked him. Maybe you can't see the movement. But God's plans never stand still. You can't bother them and you can't stop them. For the writer here tells us that angels were with God. Pardon me, please. So, to Israel, we see in this vision, Babylon was a desolate place. Babylon represented a valley to Israel, a valley of depravity, a valley of disfranchisement, a valley of hopelessness, a valley of dry bones, a valley of lifelessness. In one of the great cities of the ancient time, Babylon to Israel was a valley. someone might marvel, if Babylon was a great city, how could it be regarded by the Israelites as a valley? Well, you see, a city may be one thing to one people, or a country may mean one thing to one people, and altogether another thing to another people. When the white Europeans came to this country, embarked upon these shores, America to them was a land of promise, was a mountaintop of possibility, was a mountaintop of adventure. But to the Negro, when he embarked upon these shores, America to him was a valley. A valley of slavehood, a valley of slavery and oppression, a valley of sorrow, so that often we have to say, one of these days, I'm going to eat at the feast and pray. One of these days, the chariot of God will swing low. I wish I had somebody here praying with me. So that Babylon to Israel was a place of hopelessness. It was a valley of dry bones. A valley of dry bones. Well, the prophet tells it. And considering a prophet, what is a prophet anyway? Since the prophet was God's representative, God's ambassador, God's watchman there in Babylon. You know, and the word prophet can be interchanged with the word preacher. For a prophet is a preacher. And a preacher ought to be a prophet. Not a prophet such as we are told and talk about sometimes. Not a funny person. Not somebody with their head tied up or selling luck or anything like that. Not that kind of prophet. But I mean a real prophet. A prophet called of God. A prophet born of God. A prophet sent from God. A prophet inspired of God. For a prophet is one who knows the past, who understands the present, and out of his knowledge of the past and his insight of the present, he's able to predict the future. A prophet is one who has sight, insight, and foresight. With sight, he looks on things. With insight, he looks into things. With foresight, he looks beyond things. Such a man was Ezekiel. And he uses the symbol of a valley to describe Israel's Babylonian situation. The symbol of a valley. But you see, a valley suggests a low place between mountains. And to Israel, there were obstructing mountains surrounding her. Her situation in Babylon. Economic mountains. Social and political mountains. Religious mountains. Encircled and enclosed her in. And she was down there in the stagnant air of a valley in Babylon. So that he said that he was in the spirit. And that gives validity to it, you know. People speak a little bit about the spirit now. But I'm afraid that the church is losing a great deal of its spiritual consciousness. It wasn't unusual for folk to say, when I was growing up as a boy, the Spirit through me to do certain things. Or I was led by the Spirit to do certain things. So that this prophet was a spiritual mind, a spirit-filled, God-conscious prophet. And he said, why being in the Spirit, the Lord led him out to the valley. And then led him to the midst of the valley. And sat him down in the midst of it. But he was really saying that God led him to the heart of Israel's problem and Israel's situation in battle. That's what he was saying. God took him in a stop-doing service, in a stop-doing analysis and understanding of Israel's Babylonian situation. And when the Lord had led him to the heart of Israel's problem, set him down there, then for fear that way out on the periphery of things, he'd miss something. Then the Lord led him round and about for that, or took him and encompassed for that, circled it on all sides, that he might not miss the remotest problem of Israel's situation. And when the survey was far and complete, the Lord poured the question to him. Son of man, son of man, I wish you could hear me. Can these bones live? That son of man seemed to be reminiscent of man's limitation. Reminiscent of man's finiteness. Man's humanity. Son of man. Son of man, you are a scholar. You are an educator. Son of man, you are a scientist. Can these bones? Son of man, you are an engineer. Can these bones live? Son of man, you are a heart specialist. Son of man, you are a geologist. You are a botanist. You are a specialist in various stages of the human body. You are a psychologist and psychiatrist. You know all about drives and reactions and responses and tendencies. No, with all of this knowledge, can you tell me, can these bones live? Can these bones live? Son of man, you found pathways in the air. You have circumvented the earth. Son of man, you found highways upon the sea. And you've made your own highways under the sea. Can these bones live? Can these bones live? Bit of life. Oh, we know a lot of things. We know what the human problems are. We know men are mean. We know men are prejudiced. We know that men are narrow-minded. And we know they are selfish. We know men are unkind, ruthless, and cruel. We know men are murderers and sinful. But what we don't know is what to do about it. Well, we know what the problem is. We've made an analysis of it.
We have already died and lost the case. Yes. But what we can't do is write a prescription. Yes.
I wish I had somebody here praying with me.
So that the prophet had to say, Lord, thou knowest. Lord, thou knowest. When it comes to the answer of many of life's perplexing problems, when it comes to a solution to these problems, Lord, thou knowest. I submit myself before you. Limited, finite, ignorant and helpless, like dry bones in a valley. And thou knowest, thou hast the answer. And you know that one thing about God, when we go to him sincerely, when we've been overwhelmed by some problem that we aren't able to grapple with, put it at his feet. Ultimately, if we have faith, he'll give us the answer. He'll work it out for us. And Ezekiel declared that he didn't know. And it was in the hands of God to give the answer. Why, the Lord, after Ezekiel had surveyed and had gotten a full understanding of what the Babylonian problem was, he said to him, why, you go out to give me the answer and preach to those dry bones. The Lord, it looks like a helpless thing. It looks like an unprofitable thing for me to go out and preach to dry bones. Some of the living soul that I preach to don't respond to me. And what could I expect from dry bones? But the Lord had been to go on out and preach anyhow. You know, God's ways, you know, are above man's ways. And you can't always understand why he orders you to do certain things. But if the Lord orders you to go on anyhow, why, you may not see it, but there is a way. You may not know what you're doing, but God has it worked out. I don't even know what I'm talking about. Oh, Lord. And I saw that man go out in that valley. In that valley of dry bones. Of dry bones. Oh, Lord. And stood there. And preached to those dry bones. The Lord had given him a text to preach on. Well, Lord, what can I preach to dry bones about? Oh, Lord. Lord, what kind of subject can those dry bones to hear the word of the Lord? To hear the word of the Lord. Oh, Lord. I'm sure it must have been discouraging sometime for him to stand there day and night and preach in that valley of dry bones. To preach in that valley of helplessness and in that valley of lifelessness. In that valley of hopelessness. My Lord, to stand there and preach and not be able to see what the result would be. Oh, Lord, but he preached on anyhow. Oh, yes. And then one morning, the valley began to rumble. Yes, it did. One morning, the valley began to shake. And that was a mighty moving around. Oh, Lord. Then one morning, when he looked around to observe this rumbling, dear God, he saw those dry bones in motion. Foot bones were stretching out, ankle bones, and ankle bone were moving on toward knee bone. And knee bone was connecting with thigh bones. And thigh bone was but moving on toward hip bones. Hip bones, well, they're moving toward backbone. Yes, they were. And backbone was joining with the shoulder bone. And shoulder bone was tying with neck bone. And neck bone was tying into head bone. The prophet kept on preaching. Yes, he did. Kept on preaching. Oh, it's robbers. Hear the word of the Lord. The Lord said, wait a minute now. I want you to preach on a new theme. Yeah. I want you to just to wait a little while. And let me extract matter from the universe. Yeah. And let me all of that matter to come together and form man's anatomy. Let flesh get on the bone. Let skin begin to cover those curtains. Oh Lord, but Lord, all we have now are corpses lying around. Turn now and get to the wind. Tell the wind that God will believe the Lord. Lord, Lord, and blow breath into these bodies. And that's my solution tonight. That's my answer tonight to every problem that we have. That is the hear God word. Hear God word. It's all right to go to the United Nations. It's all right to put on the international fellowship. It's all right to call on the scholar. It's all right. But I tell you what you had better do. Hear God's word. Hear God's word. In word. In word. In word. In word. In the bridge in deep water. In word. In the lamp to your soul.
And watch the boys over there.
Go ahead.